want to take just a moment to introduce both of these ladies, although I got information about Vella Evans just about 1 minute ago, so I know less about her. I looked through Ann Castleton's vitae, and I noted I could say these things about her if I knew nothing else. I could say she's a thinker, she's a writer, she's a student, she's a teacher, she's a speaker, and she's a professional. So if you know that many things about her, I think that would help you to some degree. And then I would like to tell you just a little bit about some of the things she has done as a speaker. I'm going to just give you the titles of some of her presentations and papers. The Mormon Feminist Operating from Within the Church, and that was at a Women in the Church seminar series in Honolulu, Hawaii. Marital Rape and Domestic Violence, In-Service Training in Blackstone Valley Domestic Violence Coalition, Rexburg, Idaho. Mormon Women and Domestic Violence, The Patriarchal Connections, that was 2 years ago at the Sunstone Symposium. Religion and Family Demography, Marriage, Fertility, and Household Leadership in California, Rhode Island, and Utah, Population Association of America, in 1988. Her publications include Why Women Hit, A Feminist Perspective, published in Violence and Victims, Speaking Out on Domestic Violence in Dialogue, and Utah's Mormon Women, Western Individualists or Traditional Wives and Mothers. And that was in Ethnicity and the New Family Economy. So there are some of the things that she has done as a speaker and as a writer. She is, as a teacher, has taught or is teaching at the following institutions: Rhode Island College, University of Rhode Island, Weber State, and University of Utah. And I was particularly interested, just the professional part of me, that you teach writing across the curriculum courses, because that's an interest of mine. Teaches several other writing courses, including advanced college writing, interpersonal communications, and public speaking. Her teaching areas include interpersonal and family communication, women's studies and feminist theory, and then basic introductory courses in writing and speaking. Lastly, I will tell you that she is currently writing her dissertation for her PhD from the University of Utah in Communications. She has her AM from Brown University in American Civilization and her BS from Brigham Young University. Now, Vella Evans gave me something that she said, this is more than you'll ever want to say, but it's so well done that I will read it very briefly and let you know about her. Oh, I thought you said it was more than I would want to say.
I didn't say it was so well done.
Oh, I said it was well done. That's my value judgment. I think it's well done. Vella Evans teaches in the Department of Communication in the Women's Studies program at the University of Utah. Women's Studies offers two sections a year of a course titled Women in LDS Culture. Some of her previous research includes a study of women's image in church discourse from 1830 to 1890 and an analysis of discourse directed toward the question of Mormon women's wage work. She's currently conducting research in concepts of power and empowerment strategies. She has a Mormon husband of 35 years, 4 Mormon children, 8 Mormon grandchildren, and calls herself a Mormon feminist. So that is our respondent. I will turn the time over to Ann.
After I hear introductions like that, I always want to say something like, I'm just a mother, I have 4 children. It's true that I guess resumes always highlight other kind of things than how you think of yourself. And I also like to say that Vella and I have been office mates for a while, so I was really thrilled when they asked her to respond to this paper. His first physical violence towards me was forced sex. Oops. I left when the violence came out of the bedroom and he started smacking me around. The last straw was when I was pregnant with my 5th child and my ex-husband slugged me in the stomach. The violence and overall abuse have affected me so much that after 7 years of the single life, I still shudder at the thoughts of being married. The text for this analysis and my opening quote is a transcribed interview with a woman, whom I'll call Sharon, who'd been in a physically violent and emotionally abusive marriage. She and her husband had been members of the church all of their lives. I interviewed Sharon in July of 1990 for this paper. She was 41. At the time of her marriage, she was 18 and a half. She had her first child 5 years later and ultimately bore 5 children. Before marriage, she attended 1 year of college. She worked as a secretary during the first 5 years of her marriage while her husband attended college. For most of her 16-year marriage, she thought she was battling a problem with alcohol. This situation often confuses women because the violence seems to usually be associated with alcohol. but in almost every case, some incidents of violence have occurred when the partner is not drunk. In some cultures, alcohol consumption is not related to violent behavior as it is in our culture. Anthropological evidence suggests that an individual's response to alcohol is culturally conditioned. In the United States, domestic violence has only been recognized as a social problem in the last 30 years. Women and children had to be recognized as something other than men's property before the concept of abuse could surface. Until late into the 19th century, men were the legal and physical owners of their families. As U.S. society has moved toward valuing the rights of all humans, the already existing realities of marital rape, incest, child, and spouse abuse have become visible. Though politically, domestic violence hasn't engendered interest as a national crisis, injuries... Though both men and women are violent, usually in intimate situations, 90% of injured spouses are estimated to be women. According to the March of Dimes, 3 to 4 million American women are battered every year. 20% of hospital emergency room visits by women are the result of beatings at the hands of intimate partners. These injuries are estimated annually to cost $100 million just in medical costs, not lost productivity or any of the other associated social costs. In the U.S., 4,000 women a year die from battering. In Utah, it's very hard to get the statistics because, for one thing, they don't keep statistics that are divided out by religion. But you probably know that Utah is 70% Mormon. In Utah last year, there are 11 shelters in Utah, and they sheltered 3,175 women and children. They think that that was about 12% of the actual incidence of domestic violence in Utah. Also, for some reason, I called the National Coalition to find out. Most states have a coalition in the state that is an organization of all the battered women's shelters, and often there's a couple organizations in each state that counsel abusive husbands. Utah doesn't have any coalition like that. They're the only state in the United States that doesn't. I don't know why that is. Those with limited knowledge of intimate violence frequently ask why the abused stay in the relationship and why, for those who do leave, they often return to their abusive partners. I'm going to use socialist feminist theory to explain why this is. Now, if you got a handout, I list there, about just for your interest, about the five different kind of strains of feminism. Socialist feminism is the one that looks at both the effects of capitalism and the effects of patriarchy and puts them together and says it's the combination of these two things. Are there other handouts? I only made 40. It's 8:30 in the morning. You guys are supposed to be asleep. Are there any others? There aren't. Maybe if people could sort of spread them out. I'm sorry. This paper argues that the oppression of women within the system of patriarchy is both ideologically and materially based and intertwined with the effects of capitalism. Capitalism is always assumed to be materially based. I'm going to follow Heidi Hartman's account of dual systems theory. And her definition, her account of capitalism is sort of standard Marxist theory. Her definition of patriarchy is as a set of social relations between men which have a material base and which, though hierarchical, establish or create interdependence and solidarity among men that enable them to dominate women. The material base of patriarchy is in men's control over women's labor power. This control includes limiting or prohibiting women's access to certain economic resources, denying them control over their sexuality and fertility. When is in the United States always the big battles over what contraceptives are approved for everybody to use and reproductive rights now, which is often called the fight over choice. In Western culture, this control is mainly exercised through the institution of heterosexual marriage. I'm using the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints as a specific example of patriarchy, even though almost any other organized religion would suffice. I'm Mormon. I know Mormons. That's why I'm using this as an example. And I'm using the U.S. economy as the example of capitalism. Those who are sort of purists or know a lot about economics, which I do not, would argue that the United States is not a good example of capitalism. It's more an example of statism. I'm just using it as an example of capitalism. It's also the one that I know best, and there is no true example in the world of true capitalism. This analysis will focus on how capitalism and patriarchy intersected to establish and perpetuate the conditions necessary for violence to occur and continue in intimate relationships. Capitalism needs patriarchy, i.e. the natural-seeming organization of society in male-dominated hierarchies, to maintain itself. Patriarchy serves capitalism as it perpetuates the ideology that trains females to expect to be discriminated against in the marketplace and not to focus on their earning capacities. Patriarchy helps create a docile workforce for capitalism by training women to accept male authorities, to accept unequal power situations, and to accept as natural society's gender priorities. Patriarchy needs capitalism, which discriminates against female workers as females and against those who are responsible for reproducing humans in society, our child bearers and child rearers, which are, surprise, surprise, mostly women. Capitalism serves patriarchy by making it very difficult economically for women to survive without the economic support of a male. But there's this part I have to leave out in the interest of time, but it's really my favorite. I talked to you a little bit about the history of labor in the United States and how patriarchy and capitalism weren't always, their needs didn't always match, but they sort of struck a deal and in the 19th century, and we now have sort of a capitalism and patriarchy that work well together in keeping things as they are. The feminist critique of capitalism suggests that Sharon will be discriminated, and other women, of course, will be discriminated against in a variety of predictable ways. In this process, some of the influences of capitalism are impossible to separate conceptually from the influence of patriarchy. This indicates the powerful confluence of these two institutions. And I'll just tell you a little bit about how capitalism affects women. The major economic demographic trend of the 20th century has been the move of women from the home into the labor force. And even though that's probably the major, most significant thing that has happened in the economy, what's happened at home and what's happened at the workplace does not reflect the realities that should change because of that. Women still make 65 cents on the male dollar. That's up 1 cent from 1955. We've had, 20 years of feminism, and we make now 1 cent more. That wage gap really increases significantly with age. So if you're an older woman working, it's a lot larger than that. The discrimination, if you have a handout, you can see this laid out in 6 points. I'll explain them to you. First of all, there's wage discrimination against women based on the fact that they are women. Female college graduates earn about the same as male high school dropouts. And there's a lot of books written on that subject if you want to look that up. Also, women do what is now called the second shift or double duty, in that women that are working out in the labor force are also managing their own household, so they're working two jobs. Even though there's this major demographic shift of women into the labor force, United States men still only do less than one-fourth of the household work, and that their family contribution has increased only 6% in the last 20 years, despite the fact that so many women are working. And BYU Today, last month, just had a wonderfully researched and a good article on fathers and why they're not changing, done by a professor at BYU named Hawkins, I believe. I thought it was the article talked about his research, and I found it to be very interesting on the plane last night as I came in. Another problem with capitalism in women is the sexual division of labor, in that women are really sex-typed into particular kinds of work. 70% of females work in jobs where at least 75% of the other workers are all women. And, of course, one-third of all women work in clerical work. This sex-typing is even stronger if you're doing part-time work. And the problem with it is that, of course, women are paid less for what they do. So if you're working in an all-female job, you stand to be making less. Also, there's some evidence that the more types of work are infiltrated by women, that those professions sort of devalue in the status and the amount of money that is paid for that. And we will be able to, that happened in clerical work at the turn of the century, we'll be able to see that happening as women infiltrate professions like medicine and law, that as those are getting to be 50% now, my guess is that they'll start being less lucrative. Also, there are unique characteristics of women's labor participation. For instance, the economy really reflects the male's life cycle, and what you see, which is very difficult for women who are in the reproducing years of their life. So you see women in that stage of their life dropping in and out of the workforce, trying to get seasonal work, trying to get work while the kids are in school. And what that does is leave them in often doing part-time work, which has all sorts of attendant problems, no seniority, no benefit, often no benefits. I mean, a bunch of problems are sort of associated with the fact that women drop in and out of the workforce. And it's particularly a problem in specialized markets like nursing and teaching, where you have to take a refresher course to get back in, so you can't just go back to work. And I'm sure with technology that's a problem, too. You drop out for 10 years and you come back and it's not the same. You have to be retrained. Also, there are problems associated with following just the traditional patriarchal lifestyle. By that I mean getting married very young and not having very many skills. That if you end up having to go out to work, you're unskilled, so you'll get a low-paying job. And people often look at those kind of women often look at that work as jobs, not careers. And you know, there's a variety of attendant problems, which I'll sort of articulate as we go on. Also, there's the economic effects of divorce. As you know today, alimony is very rarely awarded. Two-thirds of custodial mothers receive no child support. Women and kids, in the first year after divorce, women and kids' lifestyle or standard of living drops 73%. And in the first year after divorce, men's standard of living usually raises 42%. This explains why 77% of the people living in poverty in the United States are women and children. And thus the phrase feminization of poverty, which is popular out in the media. In Sharon's particular case, by last summer, 7 years after her divorce, her husband owed her $25,000 in back child support, and he owed the state $20,000 in back child support. In our society, I want to quote a couple of the things that Sharon said about going out to work. And why she didn't leave when her husband was so abusive. She said, "I almost left Joe when I got pregnant with the fourth child. I just couldn't work up the nerve. It was really a scary thing for me to do. It didn't have to do with what he might do to me. It had more to do with how do I support the children and just the logistics of how do I actually do this. What do I do? How do I get a job? I haven't worked for all these years." So she reaps the benefit of having followed this path. And later, when she finally did make the break, this is what she said. "My parents paid my first month's rent. The bishop gave me a janitor's job that paid $5 an hour and gave me food. My youngest child was 9 months old. I applied and was accepted at Utah Tech and started looking for a job. I applied for part-time jobs. I put applications in, and they could see my work history was old. I think that was very important. The woman who finally hired me was the only face-to-face interview that I had. She was very frank with me. She said, 'You know, you've got three strikes against you. All these kids, one of them is a baby. You just got divorced, and you haven't worked for 10 years. But I'm going to take a chance on you because I was in that position once, and someone was willing to take a chance on me.'" Now, in our society, the years women labor at home are invisible, both in the GNP and often in societies and male breadwinner psyches. They usually hurt rather than help chances in the job market. And despite her emotional and physical labor to keep the family intact and functioning, Sharon's husband didn't acknowledge her contribution. She says, "Even to this day, he claims that everything in this house is his because he bought it. He will not acknowledge that any of the work I did in the home counts for anything. I didn't do anything. He did it all." Entering the labor force and earning a paycheck produces tangible evidence of a worker's productivity. In our society, it makes you visible as a worker. Patriarchal ideologies mesh nicely with the realities created by capitalism and help create the necessary conditions for the existence of intimate physical violence. I'm going to list the 5 points that I'm going to make since some of you don't have the handout. These are the beliefs that that we find in our church that I think form part of the capitalist problem. This is the first one, that women and men have divinely appointed but different gender roles and that men as the head of the household have the responsibility and right to keep wives in line. Number two, that the central life experience of a woman is marriage. Number three, that women are responsible for the quality of intimate relations in family. Number four, that intimate violence is extremely rare, but that it is normal for men to be more physically aggressive than women. And five, that the quality of women's lives can and should be sacrificed for men's lives, children's lives, and or the good of the family. A value promulgated within the Mormon patriarchy is that families ought to be organized like the church, with a male head who is both the main breadwinner and the ecclesiastical leader. The patriarchy holds the patriarch of the family holds the priesthood. Wives and mothers have less authority in the family than the male head, but more than the children. And so from a lesson to the 16- and 17-year-old boys, this position is made clear. I quote, "A priesthood holder leads his family. The Lord has assigned his priesthood holders the responsibility of leadership in the home through the patriarchal order. Why was the man designated as the head? A very good question. The man holds the priesthood. The major role of women is to teach, train, and rear children. And the main role of men is to provide leadership for the family through the priesthood. Women submit to righteous leadership, but not demands or unrighteousness." In a July 1989 article in the Ensign, H. Brooke Peterson tried to address the issue of family abuse and violence. The word violence is never used, and the article is rather euphemistic. However, it is the first official attempt to discuss the limits of men's power in the home. Peterson writes, "In the order of heaven, the husband has the authority to preside in the home. That issue is not subject to review. How he provides, however, is subject to review and to correction if necessary. And the problem I saw with that article is that they were always dancing between saying you ought to be nice, but you have the power. And that's really a problem because power is corrupting. If women had it, I wouldn't bet that they wouldn't do the same thing. But that dichotomy, they just dance around it. And I mean, it just is not going to really do the job. For Mormons, the overt rhetoric preaching rigid sex roles is becoming rare now that that's not socially acceptable. But it is supported by material reality. The church's 15 most powerful leaders are all male. Of the 50 or more middle-level leaders, there are three groups of female presidencies. And you probably know what they do, that they manage the children and the other young women and the other women. But they're not in the same management tract as the males. They can be abruptly and arbitrarily released from their callings by male leaders, the top 15 of which serve with lifetime appointments. Within local congregation, of course, a similar organization exists. Mormon men often have no trouble maintaining their position as supreme authority in the household because of their role as sole breadwinners. In her conversation, it was clear that Joe and Sharon both acknowledged him as the household head. They both accepted his right to tell her she could and couldn't do certain things like get a job. And she says that even though she paid the bills, she had to get permission if she ever wanted to spend anything. Though it seems to me like logic suggests that whomever spends the most time there and manages it ought to be the head of the household if you need to have that position, the position of Mormon men as heads of their household is confirmed by both patriarchy ideology and the material reality of their monopoly on the financial resources. While within patriarchy it is men's divinely appointed right to preside and provide, women also have a God-given role, motherhood. According to President McKay, motherhood is the noblest office or calling in the church. And other people have mentioned that it's sort of weird that motherhood is positioned against priesthood. It would make more sense if you did priest and priestess, mother and father. But we won't go into that. Also, and you're probably all familiar with President Benson's infamous talk in 1977 where he says, a mother's calling is in the home, not in the marketplace. She cares for and nourishes her children at home. Her husband earns the living for the family, which makes this nourishing possible. The counsel of the church has always been for mothers to spend their full time in the home in bearing and caring for their children. Work outside the home and parenting are thought to be incompatible for women, though they're expected for men. Single mothers, however, and those with severe financial needs are advised that it's better for them to accept paid employment than receive church welfare. Apparently, their children don't need the benefit of full-time mothers to the same extent as middle-class children with two parents. Supporting rhetoric holds that mothering is inherently fulfilling for women, that women are natural at parenting, that stay-at-home mothers are more likely to produce well-adjusted children, and that motherhood is the career for women. I'd just like to say, as a social scientist, that those ideas are not supported in the social science research literature. But Sharon's experience was predictable within that ideology. She says, I have been taught my whole life that the women's place is in the home, and Joe had been taught that too. I supported us while he was in school. For a period of time, I was our total support, and that was okay. I guess that was because we didn't have the kids. I didn't work once we started having kids. And then she goes on to say later that he wouldn't let her work, that even when she had everything arranged, daycare and all of that, he wouldn't because she had children, and he said she ought to be home. It is in small and gradual steps that intimate partners can go from their beliefs in divinely given gender roles to abusive interactions where the goal is to gain and maintain control over the person in the weaker position. Researchers frequently note the positive correlation between strongly held beliefs about rigid sex roles and the occurrence of violent and intimate relations. And I think that's the important point, why I would argue that there's probably more intimate violence in Mormon families than in other families, is that there's a real correlation between rigidly held sex roles and violence. You don't do research that tells how it falls out, so I don't know that for sure, but theoretically that follows. Official patriarchal rhetoric continues to articulate men's and women's different roles with the insistence that they are of equal importance. I don't buy that. And here's a quote from Widso. Women has her gift of equal magnitude. And President Smith said, and there is nothing in the teachings of the gospel which declares that men are superior to women. But no one ever tries to argue that men's responsibilities are equal to women's, because that's obvious. The best indication that women's roles are not of equal importance to men is the frequent attempts to assert that they are. If they were, we probably wouldn't have to talk about it. In the church, the problem of the disparity between the value placed on men's responsibilities versus women's is reinforced socially in the high amount of respect, attention, and status given to the words, roles, and responsibilities of men, both in their religious and breadwinning capacities. Capitalism's weak to non-existent monetary response to women's work in the household and public economy reinforces this disparity. For men with a desire to control, it can be a very short step from being divinely appointed as the head of the household to complete autocratic control over the family, maintained by a monopoly on the family's economic resources. Violence is but a step beyond that. Okay, and the second of the patriarchal ideologies is that marriage is the central life experience for women. It is the ultimate life goal for females. They are expected to marry at a younger age than males. In their religious education, Mormon girls hear much about marriage, but very little that is positive about careers, and nothing about the importance of higher education as it relates to careers. I say that because of what's in the manuals. What is actually taught is hopefully different. That courtship, dating, and temple marriage are discussed often in lessons to the 12 to 18-year-old females underscores the assumption that marriage is the divinely preferred life track and that adolescence is the time to prepare for it. While the girls prepare for marriage, the boys prepare for missions and college. And then I noticed each of the girls' manuals have sections on missionary work. In none of these sections do they ever suggest that girls go on missions. They always tell them how to support men or how to be missionaries at home. It's sort of weird because there are 8,000 women out serving missions. There are mission presidents who are dying for women missionaries, and women aren't getting married at 21 anymore, thankfully. So it's weird that that isn't ever addressed in the teachings to the young girls. That women make up 20% of the missionary workforce. But not one sentence in the manuals indicates that girls could help the missionary cause by serving themselves. The expectation, then, is that females should be marrying in their late teens or early 20s. Not surprisingly, Utah females marry much earlier than the national average. And the problem with that is that the best way you can predict divorce is by how young, by your age at first marriage. And it's a curvilinear relationship. And I'm saying the best predictor of marriage is like how long the marriage lasts. So if you get married between about 19 and 24, you're more likely to be divorced unless you get married late in your 20s. Then if you wait till your 30s, it's like you might as well have gotten married in your 20s. It's the same problem. So it goes like this. Marrying young feeds into high divorce rates and the economic issues previously articulated. Sharon married at 18. When asked if anyone tried to dissuade her from marrying at such a young age, she says, "I didn't have great role models. I don't remember having anyone fighting me about it. I don't remember having those kind of conversations with my parents where they sat me down and said, 'Now what are you going to do with your life?' or tried to give me guidance as to what kind of things I could do or what kinds of options were open to me. It was kind of like as long as I was doing things that didn't rock the boat, it would be fine." If women come to believe that marriage is their central life experience, they will be vulnerable on a number of fronts. There is the practice of first very young women, like in their early 20s, marrying men in their late 20s. Wide age gaps in the 20s set up inequality between partners as part of the initial conditions of the marriage. There is also belief that a poor match is preferable to no match at all, and there is a tendency to keep a marriage together at all costs. All of these conditions make the possibility of intimate violence more likely. My third point, American culture in general, and Mormons in particular, assume that women are responsible for the quality of intimate relations. The quality of intimate relations hasn't historically been seen as important, so it's sort of just another one of the invisible, emotionally burdensome responsibilities that women take on. Mormon women are the caretakers of their families and are responsible for the ambiance of their homes and family relationships. They are taught at monthly homemaking meetings, nutritional information, house cleaning suggestions, crafts, basic sewing, and baking skills. They are taught relational skills, how to appease and appeal to their husbands, how to create harmonious and beautiful homes. Women in abusive relationships are especially harmed by the belief that they are responsible for the quality and happiness of their intimate relations. When Sharon was in the midst of surviving her husband's constant abuse, she still hid his behavior, this is very common, from almost everyone, including her family and her church community. She says, "I thought it might be a reflection on me. Joe seemed to believe that I was responsible for the success of the relationship and his happiness. It has always been my fault that he drank and that anything bad that happened, happened. If he had a lousy day, it was my fault because I wasn't being a good wife for him or I wasn't at his beck and call." The fourth point is also prevalent in the country as well as the Mormon culture. It's the belief that intimate violence is rare. This despite recent evidence that one out of four marriages will experience violence sometime during the marriage. My own research of couples in Utah, which is not extensive and is not a random sample, indicates that it's probably more common than that. Statistics predict that violence occurs in several families in each congregation. Religious leaders persist in believing that active religious men would be unlikely to be violent. And I should say that wives would unlikely to be violent too, because wives seem to be just as violent as husbands. They're just not as strong. But as previously noted, beliefs about rigid sex roles, which is fundamental to patriarchy, make it more, not less likely that violence will occur in a Mormon relationship. The persistence of the belief that violence is a rare event endangers victims. Though it is clear that physical abuse is incompatible with the gospel of Jesus Christ, several factors allow it to be ignored and invisible within the institutional church. Male leaders who have trouble believing it happens as often as it does also have trouble hearing and understanding the evidence from their female ward members. They minimize it. Female victims often speak very euphemistically about the abuse. Sharon says that she was very good at hiding it. Women probably do this to protect themselves as well as their husbands, since they believe they are responsible for their husband's behavior. Bedfellows with the violence is rare myth is the expectation that men are naturally more physically aggressive than women, so their behavior, while not applauded, can be excused as normal. My stake president, after hearing my own story of violence, ended the discussion by replying, "Well, I know I've done things in my life that I regret." It is not surprising, then, that physical abuse doesn't seem to be taken very seriously by church leaders. I say this not because there haven't been some recent examples of official rhetoric decrying abuse among families. There have, though they can be faulted for being general and euphemistic rather than specific. But the church excommunicates members for sins they consider most heinous. Currently, members can be excommunicated for adultery, preaching false doctrine, and preaching against church leaders. None of these sins have as much potential to seriously harm or jeopardize human beings' lives as does intimate violence. There is no standard institutional response in our church to intimate violence. These patriarchal attitudes have material and physical consequences. Church leaders ignore the chance of physical injury and seem unable to acknowledge the terror of family members who are at the mercy of a physically stronger, angry spouse or parent. Church leaders are not oriented or trained to be knowledgeable about abuse. Hence, many mistakes are made as a direct result of their ignorance and inability to see and hear intimate violence. Some church leaders knew about Sharon and Joe's abusive marriage, but their belief system was such that their behavior probably exacerbated rather than alleviated the problem. At one period of time, both Sharon and Joe decided they wanted to get their spiritual act together and square up with the church. Sharon says, "This was in the midst of all the violence. I was pregnant again. I went to the bishop and confessed this thing I had done many years before, and Joe confessed the things he'd done, and they didn't do anything. The thing that bothered me the most is that in my mind what he did was so much more serious than anything I ever did as far as sins you commit and abuse and all his affairs and everything else, and they didn't do anything. We both got informal probation. Big deal. I commit one indiscretion, and he's lived a life of them, and they don't do," and then his face, "because they thought they were helping him. I think what that does in his mind is that it made it okay for him to continue as he was because he thought, I'm okay, the church lets me do this, I haven't lost my membership, I must be okay. And they actually let him baptize Ted and bless Dan. I was mad about that, angry. He's confessed all these things, but he's still a drunk and a wife abuser, and they are letting him perform these ordinances that are supposed to be so holy and sacred and reserved for people that are worthy. That made me mad. I have always felt they were wrong, and their inaction allowed him to continue his behavior without remorse. The final contributing ideology, and one that is subtle and particularly insidious, is the belief that women should sacrifice their own lives and futures for their children, husbands, and families. One example of this sacrifice is that some church leaders encourage acknowledged homosexual men to marry heterosexual females. The message here is something about the non-existent or unimportant nature of female sexual desires and an overall willingness to sacrifice a heterosexual woman's chance for a sexually compatible relationship in the effort to rehabilitate a man back to heterosexuality. Women are advised, I don't know if that's still happening, probably not because people have made a fuss, but I don't know. Women are advised to stay with abusive men for the children's sake because their husbands need them or to keep the family intact. Wives, independence, and growth is frequently sacrificed when they remain economically dependent on their husbands, which the church urges them to do. Sharon's leaders focused on rehabilitating her husband to the exclusion of concerns about her children, herself, and maintaining appropriate standards of behavior. When asked if the church leaders were concerned about her when they learned of the abuse, Sharon says, "I don't think they did anything about it. They had conversations with Joe, and he was trying to get better, and I guess that was good enough. Their attitude seemed to be that if we supported him in trying to get better, and if we continued to let him still be in the church, that somehow encouraging him that way was going to help him. But I don't believe my priesthood leaders ever talked to me about how the abuse was affecting my life and my attitudes." The effects of patriarchy were insidious in the way they shaped Sharon's values, her willingness to tolerate abusive behavior, and her understanding of her alternatives. It should not be surprising, then, that Sharon stayed married for 16 unhappy years and that the abuse had to escalate to full-fledged physical violence and marital rape before she felt compelled to escape. Given the powerful confluence of patriarchy and capitalism, it is more surprising that so many women escape and that only 50% return to their abusive partners than the reverse. In this particular case, the good news is that Sharon is now completing a master's degree in philosophy and seems happy and well-adjusted, though she's terrified of the idea of marriage. But what happens to those with fewer skills, lower self-esteem, and even more incapacitating family situations?
My paper is titled, The Dangers of Righteous Dominion and Other Priesthood Privilege. If you don't want to hear that, this would be a good time to make a move. And I like your paper very much. I think it's a reasonable application of Hartman's dual system theory and provides a good account of Sharon's abuse. My criticisms are few, but I have questions and additions that might strengthen your case. Your paper suggests that patriarchy combined with capitalism keeps women in abusive situations. But you just said that Mormonism was only one kind of patriarchy and that you could have talked about any other kind and it would have worked as well. And I'm not sure that I disagree with that, so I'm going to present my own argument, which is that authorized priesthood dominion in the Mormon home combined with greater priesthood privilege within the church and greater priesthood recognition make Mormonism a distinct and unusually potent patriarchal system. I believe that church members receive very mixed messages concerning power and relationships, and for some this could lead to abuse. To your paper, suggestions and corrections first. One, you assume that you can generalize from the experiences of Sharon. You take Hartman's model and find occurrences in Sharon's discourse that illustrate features of the model. I think this may be dangerous. Is Sharon representative of all Mormon women, of abused Mormon women? How do you know? Do you have corroborative data from a sufficiently large population of abused Mormon women? You might pursue your efforts to analyze the culture. The manuals that you refer to written for adolescent Mormons are one source of cultural values. I'll indicate other sources later. Second, you state that physical abuse doesn't seem to be taken very seriously by church leaders, and Bert Peterson's 1989 article in the Ensign was, quote, the first official attempt to discuss the limits of men's power in the home. Wrong, wrong, wrong. Oh, and I spent the last several weeks looking through all of the Melchizedek Priesthood manuals for 1980, 1991, and through the Ensign. There's just a plethora of articles which are addressing abuse and relationships and power. They're addressing it seriously. They're doing a good job. But it's the mixed messages, I think, that are coming from priesthood stature, privilege, and authorized dominion in the home that are causing the trouble. Anyway, the church is addressing the question. It is definitely addressing the question. And in the last decade, it's also modified both rituals and policy to give greater equality to women than they've had before. Sisters no longer need to covenant to obey their husbands. In addition, bishops and state presidents need no longer consult with a husband prior to calling their wife into a church position. Women may now receive their own endowments, even if they are married to unendowed or even non-member men. And members guilty of spouse abuse may not hold church office or temple recommends. These changes, combined with demonstrated concern over domestic abuse, should have positive effect. They will not eliminate abuse, however, partly because there are still elements of doctrine, ritual, and culture that empower males at the expense of females. At its most fundamental level, the church is organized around a set of priesthood master symbols that increase male prestige and privilege, placing women at risk for abuse within their homes. Some church policies and much of Mormon culture favor men. In the official language concerning such matters, couples are sealed, and women are sealed to men. However, men are not sealed to women, and the difference may reflect the fact that his stewardship and dominion encompass her, but her stewardship does not encompass him. This raises the issue of power within the home. Whatever his intent or skill, the male is expected to lead. Members of the Aaronic priesthood have leadership rights. The 1990 Melchizedek Priesthood Manual observes every sister should look to a brother who holds the priesthood, whether he is 12 years of age or older, and look to him for strength and counsel and direction. Male leadership is a fundamental feature of the separation of roles within the church. Male leadership in the home is neither optional nor temporary. The 1988 Melchizedek Priesthood Manual observes, in the home, the presiding authority is always vested in the father and there's no other authority paramount. The same manual later contends, to begin to strengthen the priesthood, brethren, we must return the fathers to their divinely appointed place at the head of the family. And the manual explains the man's presiding role, quote, every family is a kingdom, a nation, a government, within itself to a certain extent, and the head of the family is the legislator, the judge, the governor. This is what constitutes the patriarchal office. President used these strong power terms. He said he disliked the term rule. It, quote, gives the wrong impression. I would prefer the word presides, because that's what he does. A righteous husband presides over his wife and family. Note the preposition over. Every association in every dictionary I've looked for dominion has a power or control related term. This statement is frequently used, however, the righteous husband has dominion, presides. This statement is frequently used as evidence that male leadership is benign. However, President Kimball believed priesthood dominion in the home should also be extensive and exclusive. Quote, no sane woman would hesitate to give submission to her own really righteous husband in everything. And he admitted he was, quote, sometimes shocked to see the wife take over the leadership, naming the one to pray, the place to be, the things to do. Priesthood dominion is more than exclusive and extensive, however. The 1988 manual observes that, quote, the patriarchal order is of divine origin and will continue throughout time and eternity. The assignment is not necessarily based on qualification, but is largely a question of law and order. Law and order are certainly good criteria by which to establish policy. Another good criterion might be effectiveness. Shared leadership can be effective, and the turns can be rotated or decided on the basis of which person has the best resources for the specific occasion or need. Another criterion would be growth promoting for both people involved. Such is not the case in Mormonism. The male leads, and the most popular doctrinal explication of priesthood dominion is located in the 121st section of the Doctrine and Covenants, verses 36 to 42. These verses explain the constraints affecting priesthood power. The focus is the contrast between righteous and unrighteous dominion, but the outcome is that men may exercise righteous dominion in their priesthood offices, have power to control in marriage. The Doctrine and Covenants explains the constraints. President Joseph F. Smith explained the purpose. Taking all three together, I can state the following sentence. The priesthood holding male has righteous dominion for purposes of order. The verbs can be exchanged. Men may rule over, preside over, have control over their wives. The practical implication remains the same. Men have real and legitimate power over women. The reverse is never true. Mormon men not only have authorized power that women lack, they also have more prestige, which then increases their power. The fact that males have more prestige than females in the church can be demonstrated from the fact that official discourse gives priesthood holders and potential priesthood holders more positive attention than it gives to females. Communication theory holds that discourse responds to what is deemed important. Men are recognized more often and given more direct and indirect praise than women. They appear more visible and responsible, and a logical conclusion is they're more valuable than women. If you've read it, remember Levina Anderson's analysis of the October General Conference, which appeared in the Ensign. She put a lot of controls in place so that she didn't skew her analysis, not counting references to their scripture or Christ or Joseph Smith, and she found that speakers quoted 31 men as compared to quoting 5 women, told 30 stories that involved men only as compared to 9 stories that involved women only, named 20 men as opposed to naming only 2 women. In addition, of the 31 speakers who addressed either the combined or priesthood sessions, only 5 made any effort to use gender-inclusive language, recognizing both women and men as subject and audience for their remarks. I observed from looking at the table of contents for that November Ensign that Micheline Grassley was the only female of 23 speakers for the general sessions. No women spoke at the priesthood session, but one of 4 speakers at the women's conference was a man. No woman presents the sermonette on the Tabernacle Choir broadcast, a program that targets a non-Mormon audience, presents no Mormon doctrine, and does not require a priesthood holder speaker. These differences in visibility and responsibility suggest that men have better information and or better right to address or represent the church. Again, more prestige. Anderson's analysis of the Ensign motivated a review of my own to go back into the Ensign, and I haven't finished that study. But so far, I'm finding real discrepancies in representation. The Ensign, of course, is difficult to control for because it reflects passes of authority, of office, changes. It reports news of the church. But the Ensign has also made an effort to try to provide feature stories on men and women who are living interesting lives, good lives, accomplishing goals, have faithful service, whatever. Pat Thomas, my daughter and I, looked at the biographical and feature sketches in the Ensign through its history, and we found as we divided the Ensign into 4 quadrants that we had this kind of representation of males over females, 2-1, 4-1, 3.5-1, and 2-1. Given that what we were looking at was simply the number rather than the number of pages, and given that the pages devoted to males is greater than the pages devoted to females, the difference in space a lot is actually even greater. The Ensign covers reflect similar discrepancies in recognition. I analyzed those 246 magazines produced to date, 161 covers depicting human beings. I can't talk as fast as Anne, so I can't provide the details of all of that, but let me provide this summary of the Ensign covers. In 20 and a half years of Ensign publication, adult women are not shown in each other's company on the covers unless they are engaged in church work. Actually, there were 34 covers which had only a single individual on them featured. This would be a portrait or an illustration. 34 covers, 25 of them were prominent people in Mormon history. One, Lucy Mack Smith, the prophet's mother, was the only female on 34 covers that featured individuals. Lucy Mack Smith, shown so beautiful and so young, no one would have recognized her if it hadn't been for her name. Of the nine that were illustrations only, unidentifiable, simply used for illustrative purposes, all were men. And they were men who were preparing to go on a mission in prayer, a male homesteader standing in his doorway, that sort of thing. So here's my summary. In 20 and a half years of Ensign publications, adult women are not shown in each other's company on the covers unless they are engaged in church work. The reverse is not true for men who are sometimes shown in occupational and recreational activities. Aside from church work, women are shown exclusively in the company of men or children. Individual women are essentially ignored. I wouldn't claim that Ensign covers teach a forceful message, however, I do believe the covers accurately reflect a culture that ignores women's independent identity, denies their non-institutional friendship, denies any secular ambitions or activities they might have, and ultimately marginalizes the sisters as it features Mormon men. Additional research is needed to determine whether this unequal recognition prevails in other church discourse. Marilyn Carlton's here, and she did an analysis of the Church News for 80 and 84 and found discrepancies of this sort in the Church News for that period. We need to keep looking at the rest of the church discourse and see what's happening there. Studies of church magazines and manuals provide important cultural data as the publications are carefully prepared and have a large readership. Temple rituals provide a second source of information concerning gender issues in the church. The 1989 Melchizedek Priesthood Manual advises, quote, "The first and foremost important way that a priesthood bearer can share the priesthood blessings with his wife is to marry her in the temple. Promises made to men and women in the temple are equally grand and impressive. On the other hand, once the educational journey of the ceremony is begun, discrepancies in experiences appear. Only men are depicted as perfected beings. Only male voices preach and officiate. Only men demand and receive responses. And a husband accompanying his wife for their first temple experience together learns information about her that she does not have concerning him." This last point deserves consideration. Students at the University of Utah who take my Women in LDS Culture class volunteer this discrepancy first when we discuss the concerns they have over their own agency and value. Theoretically, in a perfected situation, a husband neither would nor could use his greater knowledge to his wife's disadvantage. Thus, his own advantage would have no practical effect. On the other hand, we live in a world made meaningful by symbols, and temple experience gives the men symbolic advantage. A logical conclusion, therefore, is that women are less visible, less responsible, perhaps less worthy, and perhaps deserve less respect than men. In summary, I have indicated that the church is aware of the problems of domestic abuse, is addressing the situation seriously and frequently. No man who listens to conference sessions, reads the Ensign, attends quorum meeting, or reads his priesthood manual could believe that violence is ever justified. He would learn instead that priesthood is an obligation to serve. His leadership should follow the example of Christ. I have also shown that women have acquired greater prestige and its corollary power, which I truly believe, as the church has modified ritual and culture to give women greater independence and equality with men. On the other hand, I have also argued that at the very least, the Mormon male has symbolic advantage over the female, and the mind feeds on symbols. Ordained males are explicitly authorized to exercise dominion over their wives and children. Males in general, and priesthood holders in particular, receive more recognition and more praise than women in the church. Thus, they appear more valuable. They seem primary, first, better. Women may appear to be other, lesser, not as good. Here is the first step toward justifying abuse. The victim appears less worthy than the abuser. I believe that the confluence, Anne, of doctrinally assigned power and culturally assigned prestige forms a backdrop of master symbols against which a potentially abusive man might interpret his behavior as leadership, correction, guidance, direction. all applications of male dominion and privilege. Abuse is occurring within the church, and I fear that as long as men are institutionally empowered at the expense of women, Mormon women will remain at risk for violence within their home. I want to conclude by reading something that happened a week ago. I read my paper in the Women in LDS Culture class that I teach at the University of Utah, and one of the women in the room submitted a journal after the class was over and wrote a response to my paper. I wish I could quote the response extensively. I'll simply summarize it. "You amaze me that you can write of so much pain in scholarly and abstract terms when there are real women being raped and beaten. My mother, two sisters, and I went to our state president and told him about the abuses, past and present, that my father visited upon us. My father, who denied everything, was a member of the state president's high council. Nothing ever happened to him. In contrast, I have razor scars, hospitalization records, memories, and therapists."
We have about 8 minutes for questions, so if you would speak as loudly as you can, and then, ladies, I'd ask you to repeat the question into the mic so that everyone can hear it. Yes.
Hey, President, why don't you get them say, go and get.
That's terrifying.
Thank you.
Sir?
Okay, the first thing I want to do is applaud the discussion of dependency and abuse. It's a topic that needs more discussion. And especially as a father of two young daughters, I believe that all young women need to prepare for careers to lessen dependency, and all women need empowerment and feelings of self-worth. However, the central theme of this session was the confluence of patriarchy and capitalism. I personally cannot understand how capitalism needs patriarchy. Class-maintaining society may require migrant workers, but to underemploy one-half of the workforce definitely does not contribute to capitalism. And I also know of no evidence which shows that the five conditions, wage discrimination, double duty, sexual division of labor and type of work, unique characteristics of women's work, and skip down to six, economic effects of divorce, are any different in socialistic societies and underdeveloped economies. And if there's any evidence to that effect, I'd like to hear it.
I'm better on the patriarchy than the capitalism. But I would say, I don't have to repeat the question, right?
Did you all hear it?
Okay. First of all, patriarchy serves capitalism, and capitalism needs patriarchy in that it creates a docile workforce, and that even though half of the workforce is underemployed, we can pay them half as much. That serves capitalism. That serves people who own capital. That serves the owners. So that's fairly clear, I think. I don't know if I... Lynn, do you...
Well,
you're jumping out of your chair?
Well, I just think that the other thing is it keeps these women at home so that the workforce doesn't have to do that thing, and so that the people in the workforce can keep getting richer and richer, the men in the workforce, and they still have unpaid...
Yeah, we're all unpaid workers at home, and we do all this duty that's invisible in the GNP, and we don't get paid for it, and we get penalized for it if we decide to ever go out to work. So that's a real service to capitalism.
Okay. Yes, please.
Yes, that's right. Right. Even other capitalist countries have better parental leave, family leave. Every country in the world practically has better family leave, family policies than the United States.
Will you repeat the question?
The question is, are men feeling uneasy about this authority we have, and that we might guess that they might be because there are so many admonitions in Relief Society to support them? In my word, no one would teach that lesson. they got a priesthood person to come in and teach it. Does anybody want to speak to that? I'm not a man, so I can't.
Do we have a male respondent to that question?
Glenn.
Well, people probably get sick of hearing it. I did the fathering panel and I did a males panel 2 years ago. And one thing I'd like to say, do men feel uncomfortable with that? I think for the most part, tragically not. We have a society that reinforces power. We give status to power. Unfortunately, in the liberation of people, we move toward concepts of power, concepts of conquering, whether we be men and women, often. I think that's a tragedy. I think what men need to discover, and then you can all yell at me, is how trapped they are by seeking power and the price they pay for power. And I think as men become more aware of the trap of power and what it costs them in terms of intimacy, in deprivation of their own emotional being, in deprivation of a lot of those things, then power won't mean so much to them and we won't have such a need to retain our power, partly so we don't have to look at the painful conditions of ourselves.
Thank you.
One of the options that you do not hear very often explored is the option that women have to say no to us and to whoever runs the Relief Society or the ward. I mean, if you say no and you do know, then you send a message to those people and you will make them uncomfortable.
But you guys, that's the whole point of the patriarchy ideology, is that I have been socialized since the day I was born not to ever say no. And it's very powerful socialization.
We have just a minute and a half left, so I'll take these three questions and let you choose which you respond to. If you'd all, in order, ask your three questions and you can choose. One request, then, is to address denial. The second hand, right here.
I find in my experience women in this situation.
Okay, the second request is educating women who deny as well. And Kathy, the last question. Thank you for that comment. Lady?
I'm going to respond first and Anne's going to follow up. For me, a response that would apply to all three questions would be look at the culture. We do live in a network of a shared belief system. We're looking at symbols and images, and so for the man who can rewrite and reconfigure, what I'm trying to argue is what are the most powerful symbols and images in the culture? And you can rewrite your own behavior by indexing or accessing very powerful symbols which will allow you to reinterpret what's going on. And I think that the powerful symbols in Mormonism are that the male has power, it's authorized power, and he has prestige that the woman doesn't have. In response to Ardeen's statement, a lot of times I get castigated for women are petty, they're coming from a petty position, they're just caviling after having everything that men want. William Buckley has an editorial to that effect in this morning's Tribune. It's not that they're caviling after pettiness. It's that this discrepancy, this inequality, puts them at risk for very bad treatment.
I wanted to address the question about education and how you educate women. And in that, also respond to two of Vella's critiques of my work. One was this one woman's case representative? And I cannot say that it is I can't prove that it is representative. But, you know, once I sort of came out with my own story, people wrote to me, people talked to me. I'm a social scientist. I know that's not proof. I have to say that I think I would say that the case I quoted was a mild case from the things I hear. And with the patriarchy, it's a setup. I mean, that's bound to happen because people don't always have to account for their behavior. Also, the difference between Vella asserted that things were being addressed, and I defer to her. She sounded like she was much more up on that than I was. That while official church rhetoric seems to be addressing this problem, I would say that it's very euphemistic and that the practice is significantly different than the rhetoric.